Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Hello, my name is Derek, and I'd like to welcome everyone to the Tattered Cover Bookstore this evening, and I want to thank everybody for coming out and supporting their local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference. Tonight we have a great treat. I've spent the last few minutes talking with tonight's author. It's been a lot of fun, and I know you guys will have a lot of fun as well. For those who may not be as familiar with his work, I think tonight's author kind of sprang onto the literary scene with his first book, The Little Book. I think I have one right here, which was amazing in a couple different ways. The first way would be that it was this incredible story that was a mixture that had elements of time travel, that had pop culture ideas, had big ideas, big personalities, and big thinkers from especially the beginning of last century. The second thing was just the process it took to finally make it into our hands, that it took, well, we were talking about 33 years from kind of original conception of the idea, then revision and sending it away until it finally got into the version that we all read and enjoyed. So those two stories really got it going, as it does. But the talent that and all those things that were so great in the first book certainly are true in the new one, The Lost Prince, where we actually follow one of the characters from the little book, Eleanor, as she is now, World War I and a little bit afterwards, just how she's making her way in the world with her own little book in a way. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce tonight's author, Selden Edwards.
Thank you, Derek. I am just honored to be here. This is my second, as some of you know, this is my second time standing here, and it's just such a treat. There's one person here I have known since he came out of the womb. My nephew Charlie is here. He knows that I labored long and hard on my first story, and I think all of you know it, but I'll just quickly review it, that this saga, of which now this is the second leg, and I hope there will be another, this saga began, I was sitting with a friend of mine on our deck at Lake Tahoe in 1974. I was about ready to take, I had been teaching for 10 years, and I was going to take a year off, and I did take a year off and got a master's in education at Stanford, and my friend is a sort of intellectual guy, and he was reading a great book called Wittgenstein's Vienna about this amazing period at turn of the century Vienna, which was the groundwater in which the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein grew up. And he was saying, I ought to read it because it's just a fascinating story. And he was saying, you know, and you really should read it because it's so important with Ludwig Wittgenstein. And I was going... You know, I had been writing for about 4 or 5 years, and I was writing short stories and sending them out to magazines, and they were being summarily rejected. And I had never had any encouragement, but that continued for 40 years. But I said, you know, if you could time travel back there, you could find the child Hitler and you could kill him. And I thought, you know, that's going to be my meal ticket. That's going to be the thriller that's going to make me make my name. So we talked a lot, and then I read the book, and I got the background. And when I got to Stanford, in my idle moments when I was bored, I would go to the library and do some research on the time period. And I started to write. Oh, and then at some point in that year, I approached an English professor that I had, and I asked if I could write a novel as independent study in the spring term. And he said I could. So I started this manuscript, which was going to end up being about 250 pages, and I basically said Wheeler Burden. I typed Wheeler Burden. The name came to me. I don't know where it came from, but the first day, and it was typewriter days, you know, just Wheeler Burden. So I liked the sound of it. It was sort of like my name, you know, a last name, first name. And I had none of the explanation of where his name came from was in my head at that point. So I started to write. And then the only little wrinkle was I had decided, I had taught a number of times Franz Kafka's short story, The Metamorphosis, about a guy who wakes up in the morning and discovers he's a beetle. And the brilliance of that story is it's never an explanation of how he became a beetle, and you're just expected to accept it. And when you think about it, if you're going to write a time travel story, it saves a lot of time if you don't have to explain it. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go for it. And so I never explained how Wheeler Burden got there. I knew he had to be there because of this thriller I had in mind. And I finished it, 250 pages, and it was a little bit the rough outline of the story. And already the plot to kill Hitler had moved a little bit to the background because I started a love story, and then that became more interesting to me than the kill Hitler, although that was in there. And then I handed it in, and I got credit for it. And so if you look at my transcript from Stanford, somewhere in the great computer, it'll say independent study, novel, P. Because I asked if we pass fail, because I didn't want him to. I knew he didn't like it very much, and I didn't want him to give me a grade on it. And so so I sent that around a couple of times. I sent it around to publishers. In those days, you could send directly to publishers, and it was just totally rejected. Just almost came back by return mail. And I put it away. And then about 5 or 6 years later, I had the urge to write a novel again, and I thought, well, I already have that one started, so I went back and added to it, and I did that every 5 or 6 years for 33 years, and it doubled in complexity, probably doubled in complexity each time. So if you double a number 6 times, you get to 64. So the final draft is 64 times more complex than and thank God I stopped, right? So that was the story. And Freud is a major character in the first story. And I'll tell you just a second how that happened. That happened by total coincidence. And then Jung is the center of the second story. And they're both main characters, but they really are, it's the fulcrum of the story. And the first story, for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is some of the love relationships, is a Freudian story. It has a Freudian feel to it. Well, the second story became sort of a Jungian story. And Jung was a great believer in the collective unconscious, in the depth of the unconscious. And he, like Freud, believed that myths and dreams were the expression of the unconscious. Freud, I think it was, who actually said, dreams are the myths of individuals, and myths are the dreams of cultures. And what it is, it's the unconscious cannot express itself. It doesn't have any language. And so all it can do is come out in dreams and myths. But I think also it comes out for writers in what they write. And you sort of say, because I taught English for 40 years, and kids were always saying, oh, come on, he didn't mean that. You know, Moby Dick is not a symbol. Moby Dick is just a whale. But it is a symbol. It comes out of the depth of the writer, and there's no explanation of why he would ever tell that story if you didn't really get into this unconscious level. So this second story has a lot of the unconscious in a different way from the Freudian part. And then if I ever stop talking and get back to work, incidentally, I am a very extroverted person, and I love talking. Most writers are very introverted and hate talking, but I'm the opposite, and it's very hard for me to sit down, and I love talking about what I'm going to do. when I would pull an all-nighter in college, which was very rare, I would stay up most of the night talking about what I was going to do and not doing it. But anyway, if I ever get back to work, I have a third... there's a third part to the story, which is the World War II part of the story, and it's Dilly and Flora's story, and Joseph Campbell is a main character. So that would sort of finish my idea of the loop of mythology and the unconscious and how that goes. So anyway, there's that. Derek and I were talking about interpretation, how readers interpret what you write. And I learned right from the beginning, never deny anything. You know, if somebody calls you and says, wow, I read your book and it just, I know you're really interested in Cole Porter. And I just, I want you to know that the International Conference of Cole, this really happened. The International Conference of Cole Porter Lovers is going to be in Portland and you could actually go to it. Noel Coward. Noel Coward is mentioned one time in the little book. When Dilly and Flora meet and they have their one magical day when they form their relationship, they end up wanting to spend the evening together, and so they go to a play. And I figured it was 1939, and in those days I thought my novel was never going to be published, so I didn't really do any research, but I sort of grabbed for Noel Coward because I figured, you know, he must have been writing during those days. So I said, I just grabbed it and put it in, it's in there, Noel Coward. But when she read that, you know, it resonated with her magically and just probably made the whole scene come alive for her. And often you do that, you just sort of grab a detail. And then for the reader, it means an enormous amount because you're telling the story, and if it's a good story, then the reader is, you know, involved in it. So I lost my train of thought. That was such a fascinating detail that I lost my train of thought. And I will tell you one more funny one. This guy writes me an email from a Danish guy writes me an email from Vienna. Actually, he says I'm here. And I have your book, and I'm going to all the sites. And so he went to all the places. He went to the Café Central. He went to the Opera. He went to all these places that are mentioned in the book. Okay, so he walks into the Hotel Imperial. The first scene when Wheeler steals the clothes, he overhears the obnoxious American telling the man to take the clothes to room 433, and so then he goes up to room 43, and that's where he steals the clothes. Okay, so he goes to the Danish guy goes up to the counter at the Imperial Hotel, and he says, "Take me to room 433." There are 25 rooms on the fourth floor, so there is no room 433. You know. I was committed. Actually, when the paperback came out, I asked my editor if I could change it. He said, "No, you can't. You can't do that." So I wrote him back and said, "Yeah, I know that. it's fiction." You have to fill your story with details, and sometimes they're meaningful, and sometimes they just don't mean anything at all. But my point is that readers respond in a very visceral way once they buy into the story. If they don't buy into the story, then they go to sleep, you know, and that's the end of that. They put it away. And you know the number of times you picked up a book and never finished it. And then you pick up a book you can't put down. So anyway, that I have developed an enormous respect for reader response. Okay, so the end of the little book comes. And it just as it was being readied for publication, here's an interesting thing too. If you see an actor at a premiere of a movie, they're usually really indifferent about that movie because they're knee-deep in the next project. And it's really hard for them to go back and remember what it was like. But that's all the reporters want to hear about. So they're having to be interviewed about something they don't care about. And well, the same way with an author. Whenever you hear an author talking about his published book, usually he or she is knee-deep in the next project and has to... has to go, oh yeah, did I do that? You know, did I say that? So about as it was being published, I did come up with this idea of a trilogy, that you have Wheeler's life span, and then you have 1897, and there's this gap in between. The good news is that a lot of the details have already been discovered by me. The bad news is a lot of the details have already been discovered by me, because it ties you into, you know, ties you into a corner. And so many times when writing this book, I said, oh God, I wish I had not said that. Totally out of the blue, I say in the little book that, well, I don't want to talk too much because some people haven't read the little book, and I don't want to blow any surprises. But when Wheeler and Dilly are talking about how Dilly's mother lived her life, Dilly tells Wheeler a bunch of stuff, and Wheeler goes home and writes it into the journal. So the journal is filled with details about how Wheezy is going to live her life, or did live her life, depending on how you look at it. And at the end of the little book, there's that absolutely chilling scene where Wheeler forgets and leaves the journal in the studio, and Wheezy reads it. And I mean, that makes, I mean, on all different levels, that's how the story ends. But that's a shock. And so when she leaves Vienna, if you will remember, she leaves with three items of inestimable worth: the journal, the ring, the fabulously valuable ring, and the manuscript that she has written that is going to become the little book. So we see her arriving in Vienna in 1897 with this torn apart. You know, she's had a devastating experience, and she's a very courageous person, as we know. And so she's putting her life back together, and she has this this challenge. But she only knows history in tiny little bits and pieces. So she doesn't know everything that's going to happen. She knows there's going to be a World War I. We know, I'm not giving away anything because we know that. She knows there's going to be a World War II. She knows that her family is going to be devastated by both of them. And she knows that there's some investments that she's going to make that are going to make her an extremely wealthy woman. But she doesn't know if she has to do it herself or if she's supposed to sit back and wait for it to happen. Well, obviously with World War I, there's nothing she can do about that. But some of the other things, is she supposed to get up and go do it, or is she supposed to wait? And so she's really she's got a big cross to bear. That's where we see her in the beginning. And then in the first two pages, there is a, if you know the story, there's a shocking scene that sort of kicks off the second book, and we go from there. She's going to, she knows that she is supposed to supply the money in 1909 that's going to allow Freud and Jung to come to America at the Clark University conference, which is true, and she's the one who's supposed to make that happen. And in the process, she meets Carl Jung, and they are, shall we say, kindred spirits and very fond of each other. And so that's her, that's sort of where the story's going. And then we already know from a little bit in the little book that she's very close to William James. And when William James, right at near the end of his life, went to the 1909 conference, he was not impressed with Freud and very impressed with Jung. And so there's some themes going on there. As you know from the little book, that paternity is not certain in a number of cases, and it continues. Finally, somebody who's read both books well and was doing an interview said, what problem do you have with simple paternity? And I sort of said, wow, I never thought of it. But there are some surprises yet to be found. I want a couple of more things. I want to tell you how Freud... Oh, I'll tell you, here's a funny one. Just before the big book expo, the American Book Expo in New York in the beginning of June, Publishers Weekly called me and wanted to interview me. And I was excited. I love interviews. Reluctant as I am to speak. And I hadn't really thought it through. I have talked so much about the little book that there's little, all those things I just told you, the phraseology, if you go back over time and look at the things I've said, I say the same things over and over again because I just, that's just the way I talk. I've talked about it so much, every nuance that I've talked about, but I had never talked about the new one. And all of a sudden I'm in this interview and I sort of roared, I didn't really think very much about it, I roared into the interview. And about halfway through, she said to me, "What would you like the reader to take away from your book?" And I was stunned. I couldn't speak. I had no idea how to answer that question. Now I have a great answer. But I said something pretty clever, and she quoted it. I said, "I could tell you, but it would take me 438 pages to do it." So... So anyway, starting to talk about it again, and when you write a story, very few people ever read it, and you have no exchange with anybody. So it's not like you every day you're confronting these characters and stuff. And so, in the beginning of the discussion part of it, it's a little bit overwhelming because you think, "Yeah, why did I do that?" But after you've been asked the same question 10 times, you finally come up with an answer that works. One of the, in this saga that's going to be going for quite a while yet, and incidentally, I believe somehow, someday maybe someone will analyze how it is my unconscious speaking to the world, but I really believe that this stuff came out of me for some reason. And, you know, it's so funny because when you sit down to write and you've never introduced a character before, and then by the end of the day you've introduced the character, that person is so integrally involved in the story that then you can't imagine the story without that person in it, you know? And that's the way it is right here, you know? This thing is complete. And where all the ideas came from, I have no idea, but they're just you writing, and all of a sudden, boom, out it comes. And then once you've committed yourself, then that's part of the story, too. So I had an underpinning of interest in depth psychology. And depth psychology is Freud, Jung, Joseph Campbell, that stuff, you know, dreams and analyzing dreams and looking at myths and all that stuff. And I have a strong interest in that subject. And so then I realized that I really wanted to tell a story in which that was sort of an undercurrent that ran through the whole thing. But Freud wasn't in it. And about 15 years into it, I was in my hometown and I ran into an old friend of mine, and he's a very intellectual guy. And everybody in my family knew I was writing this. I had this fool's errand. I was writing this novel about Vienna. And he said, "Hey, whatever happened to that Vienna novel?" And I said, "Oh, I've given it up. You know, it's a hunk of junk, and it's too complicated, and it'll never be published, and it's a waste of time." And he said, "Well, you know, I don't even know what it's about." And I said, "Oh, it's a story about this famous rock and roll star who wakes up in the morning and time travels back to Vienna at the turn of the century." And he said, "Wait a minute. Wasn't Freud there then?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You mean you have a story in which your main character could go meet Sigmund Freud, and you're giving it up?" And I sort of went, "No." no, not me. And so then it just totally opened a new dimension. And I went pretty much back to work, and I wrote a draft. And if you look at the structure of the little book, there are five sections. And originally, they were entitled the first meeting, the second meeting, the third meeting, the fourth meeting, and the fifth meeting. And then my editor said that was a terrible idea. So I just took, they're still the same sections, but I took the titles off. And it's the story of a love affair. It's the cycle of a love affair. The two of them come together and are fascinated by each other and, you know, sort of fall in love. And then the second section, they sort of get it on. And then in the third section, the troubles start, all the twists and turns start. In the fourth section, they have a breakup, and they have a bitter breakup. And in the fifth section, there's some kind of a resolution. Remember that wonderful scene in The Way We Were when Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford meet on the street at the end? Whoa! So that's the fifth, you know, the fifth version part. And then once I got Freud and Wheeler talking, and remember, eventually, Wheeler just starts reading him the journal. So eventually, Wheeler's telling him everything, more than he wants to know. But Freud is fascinated. Freud never believes, from the moment it starts all the way through this story, never believes that he's dealing with a time traveler. He thinks he's dealing with a crazy person. And it drives, finally it just drives Wheeler over the top. Wheeler sort of goes, look, I didn't choose this, but you got to accept me for what I am. And Freud says, oh, interesting, you know, and thinks he's a hysteric. Jung, on the other hand, would be all over it. There's the difference between Freud and Jung. Jung would go, well, I don't know what this time travel is, but let's think about it at least, the possibilities. And Joseph Campbell would too, probably. So anyway, that's one. And then finally, I'll just talk just Arnold Esterhazy. Same thing. Okay, here's how Arnold came into the story. Arnold Esterhazy, the great teacher. I had been reading a ton of books and articles about Vienna at the turn of the century. And remember, this is going on for 30 years. So, and the problem when you do research for a book is you really want credit for it. And if you're writing a piece of fiction, it gets out of hand, and you have these long, boring passages, but you don't want to cut them because you did the work. You know, oh, this is. And my editor at one point said to me, "You really love this stuff, don't you?" Cut it. So I had this problem of what you, sort of encyclopedic, boring descriptions of Vienna. And this is about 15 years into it, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if Wheeler Burden really understood what he was seeing the moment he arrived in Vienna? And I know, because of my years as a student and as a teacher, that there are these characters in schools who make subjects come to life so much that their students can actually go do something and know all about it, you know, because of this great teacher. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if Wheeler had a teacher? And then I thought, well, how would he have? At this point in the story, there's no Boston, there's no backstory, there's no baseball. And I said, wouldn't it be interesting if he had a teacher who taught him so, who filled him so full of these stories that when he walks down the street, he actually, you know, it comes to life? Well, that raises a really interesting narrative. And I sort of would call it the secondary narrative. And it goes like this. The narrator says, well, as my father used to say, that's good, 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 bad, bad, bad. I hate the president, you know, I hated FDR and stuff like that. You can have these colorful narrations that come in because you introduce this, you know, this character. It's in the words of the character, not the words of the narrator, sort of. So it gave me a chance to really liven up the descriptions because the Hayes, this teacher, loved the place. I mean, he thought that the world had gone downhill ever since his boyhood. And then then Wheeler would have to go to school. And I grew up in a small farming town in Northern California where there weren't too many teachers who had been to Vienna at all, let alone at the turn of the century. So I thought, well, I went my last 2 years I stayed home through my sophomore year, and then my last 2 years I went to a boarding school in Boston. Maybe it sounds familiar. So Wheeler went for his last 2 years to a boarding school in Boston where he had this teacher. Well, then I started thinking, if he was old enough, he could have actually been there. And so I did a little math and thought, well, he'd be 85. There aren't too many schools who have 85-year-old teachers, but St. Gregory's did have an 85-year-old teacher. And then I pulled the name completely out of my memory. Esterhazy is a famous Viennese aristocratic name. Actually, it's Hungarian. Famous for the period. You see the name Esterhazy a lot. And then Arnold, spelled the way it's spelled, is the French version, which I thought was sort of European. And I misspelled it. And I never didn't take... I was never going to publish my novel, so I never took the time to look it up. And so Arnold is misspelled, but it's A-R-N-A-U, and there's no L in the French version of it, but mine has the L in there. And so all of a sudden, there's this guy, Arnold Esterhazy. And of course, the boys always had nicknames for their teachers, and so they call him the Hayes, which is pretty funny because of all the things this elegant aristocratic guy was not, was any kind of hazy, but anyway, they called him the Hayes, and all of a sudden there's this character, and I put him into the page, and he takes off, and as you know, he ends up being much more important in the Burden family than just his teaching, and so off he goes, and then he was, as you know, he is there, an 18-year-old boy, And Wheezy knows, she has become Eleanor, knows that it's her job to get him to come to teach at St. Gregory's, and where her husband had gone. And how is she going to do that? She doesn't know, and so that's a strain there. But she is going to get him to come be a young teacher, which is about the last thing that would occur to him, to come teach at a boys' school in Boston. But he is devoted to his beloved Beatrice, Eleanor. And so he comes to be at St. Gregory's school. And this story is sort of, you know how the movie is about how Batman got created, the origins of Superman or stuff like that? You know, well, this is sort of the origins of the Hayes, Arnold Esterhazy. Okay, finally, I want to tell you about blurbs. One of the most exciting parts of having a book published is, frustrating too, but trying to get people to blurb the book. And you see them all the time, and sometimes you might ask yourself, how did that get there? And probably behind a lot of the blurbs, there's a great story. Well, there's really a great story behind mine. When the little book, when Dutton bought the little book, they asked me if I knew anybody, and I said, well, no, I've never published a book. I don't know anybody. But I had been a student in the 60s. I had been a fellow student with Richard Ford at the Squaw Valley Writers Conference, and I knew him a little bit, and whenever he would come speak, my wife and I would go hear him and stuff, and we'd reintroduce. And he knew me. He knew us. And so I wrote him a letter, and he said he said he might do it. Then he read the manuscript and he did it. But I sent fan letters to 10 authors, two-page fan letters to 10 authors. And I have 9 notes from famous authors saying that they really didn't have time to do it. Thank you very much for the offer. One day I was looking at my email and this email pops on the screen and it says, Donald P. Conroy, I love your beep novel. And I sort of looked. Pat Conroy uses very salty language. He can't go 4 sentences without putting in a good F word or S word or something, you know. But anyway, so I called my wife over and I said, is that what I think it is? And he said, I don't like to write what I'm going to tell you. I want to tell it to you, and could you give me your phone number? So a few days later, the phone rings, and she answers the phone, and she says, yes, yes, and she brings the phone over to me and goes like this. And he read me the blurb, and if you remember the blurb that was on the original, I don't think it's on the paperback, I can't remember. But anyway, the blurb that was on the original hardback of the little book is the most amazing blurb you've ever seen from Pat Conroy. And we, as a result of it, he and I have spent a lot of time talking to each other, and we've been to South Carolina to visit him. And he's a wonderful guy, and has become a real friend. So he knew I was writing the second novel, and he actually volunteered. And he said, I'd love to blurb it, so please have them send me a manuscript. So that the way it works is it's still the manuscript form. They send the manuscript, then you wait. And my heart goes into my throat because I had spent so much time writing the second one, and the second novel was famously difficult, and I just thought, I know what the world's going to say. It's going to be, I knew it was going to be published, you know, but I know what the world's going to say. You know, this sure ain't the little book. And so my heart was in my throat, so I'm going to, he puts this on my voicemail, so I have it forever. And I think I can do this. It was on my cell phone, so I see this Pat Conroy, and I listen, here's what he says.
Hey Sheldon, Pat Conroy, blurb time. I love Sheldon Edwards' first novel, The Little Book, and told everyone I knew about it, period. I just read his second novel, The Lost Prince, and think to Mr. Edwards has written his finest work so far, period. Once again, comma. He demonstrates a mastery in blending philosophy and art with the help of wonderful characters you fall in love with. A terrific second novel. Congratulations, big boy. You did done really good.
I mean, I have been pinching myself for 5 years. I just really, you know, after, and you have to remember the context is 40 years of printed rejection slips and no encouragement, you know. To have this happening is just a dream. So anyway, here I am. I'll answer some questions, but first I forgot. This is one of the great bookstores in the world, you know. And what an honor to be invited here. This is my second time, as some of you know, being in this room. I just want to say a little bit about independent bookstores. They are really important in the life of authors. Because what happens is the people who work at the bookstores are guys like Derek, who are just totally book lovers and totally dedicated to selling books. And the galleys come in from the publishers. The galley is a paperback version, simple paperback version of the thing that's going to come out. And the galleys roll in, and they go into the office and see things that are interesting to them. They read them well ahead of time, and then they're waiting for the book to arrive, and they hand, what they call a hand selling. Hand selling is hugely important. And you know, so I just, you know, buy books at independent bookstores. Buy books at this bookstore, and as long as you're buying books at this bookstore, buy mine. But I do want to just say that I have developed the most wonderful love affair of these stores. And now this time, second time around, I'm getting to go back to the stores that I went to 4 years ago, and I'm meeting all the people I met before, and it's just such a treat. But what an honor to be part of this. Okay. Let the signing begin. Thank you for coming. I have a lot of friends out here, and then I have some friends I don't know yet. But thank you for coming. This is great.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.